The late King Tepikaimon on the 27th opened his eyes. "I was flying," he whispered. "I remember the feeling of wings. What am I doing here?" He tried to stand up. There was a temporary feeling of heaviness, which suddenly dropped away so that he rose to his feet almost without any effort. He looked down to see what had caused it. "Oh, dear," he said. The culture of the River Kingdom had a lot to say about death and what happened afterwards. In fact, it had very little to say about life, regarding it as a sort of inconvenient prelude to the main event, and something to be hurried through as politely as possible, and therefore the Pharaoh reached the conclusion that he was dead very quickly. The sight of his mangled body on the sand below him played a major part in this. There was a greyness about everything. The landscape had a ghostly look, as though he could walk straight through it. "Of course," he thought, "I probably can." He rubbed the analog of his hands. "Well, this is it. This is where it gets interesting. This is where I really start to live." Behind him, a voice said, "Good morning." The king turned. "Hello," he said. "You'd be..."
"Death,"
said Death. The king looked surprised. "I understood that Death came as a three-headed giant scarab beetle," he said. Death shrugged.
"Well, now you know."
"What's that thing in your hand?"
"This. It's a scythe."
"Strange-looking object, isn't it?" said the Pharaoh. "I thought Death carried the flail of mercy and the reaping hook of justice." Death appeared to think about this.
"What in?" he said.
"Pardon?
Are we still talking about a giant beetle?"
"Ah, in his mandibles, I suppose. But I think he's got arms in one of the frescoes in the palace." The king hesitated. "Seems a bit silly, really, now I come to tell someone. I mean, a giant beetle with arms. And the head of an ibis, I seem to recall." Death sighed. He was not a creature of time, and therefore past and future were all one to him. But there had been a period when he'd made an effort to appear in whatever form the client expected. This foundered because it was usually impossible to know what the client was expecting until after they were dead. And then he decided that since no one ever really expected to die anyway, he might as well please himself, and he'd henceforth stuck to the familiar black cowled robe, which was neat and very familiar and acceptable everywhere, like the best credit cards. "Anyway," said the Pharaoh, "I expect we'd better be going."
"Where to?"
"Don't you know?"
"I am here only to see that you die at the appointed time. What happens next is up to you."
"Well," the king automatically scratched his chin, "I suppose I have to wait until they've done all the preparations and so forth. Mummified me. And build a bloody pyramid. Do I have to hang around here to wait for all that?"
"I assume so."
Death clicked his fingers, and a magnificent white horse ceased its grazing on some of the garden greenery and trotted towards him. "Oh, well, I think I shall look away. They take all the squishy inside bits out first, you know." A look of faint worry crossed his face. Things that had seemed perfectly sensible when he was alive seemed a little bit suspect now that he was dead. "It's to preserve the body so that it may begin life anew in the netherworld," he added, in a slightly perplexed voice. "And then they wrap you in bandages. At least that seems logical." He rubbed his nose. "But then they put all this food and drink in the pyramid with you. Bit weird, really."
"Where are one's internal organs at this point?"
"That's the funny thing, isn't it? They're in a jar in the next room," said the king, his voice edged with doubt. "We even put a damn great model cart in Dad's pyramid." His frown deepened. "Solid wood it was," he said, half to himself, "with gold leaf all over it, and four wooden bullocks to pull it. Then we whacked a damn great stone over the door." He tried to think and found that it was surprisingly easy. New ideas were pouring into his mind in a cold, clear stream. They had to do with the play of light on the rocks, the deep blue of the sky, the manifold possibilities of the world that stretched away on every side of him. Now that he didn't have a body to importune him with its insistent demands, the world seemed full of astonishments. But unfortunately, among the first of them was the fact that much of what you thought was true now seemed as solid and reliable as marsh gas. And also that just as he was fully equipped to enjoy the world, he was going to be buried inside a pyramid. When you die, the first thing you lose is your life. The next thing is your illusions.
I can see you have got a lot to think about, said Death, mounting up. And now, if you'll excuse me...
Hang on a moment.
Yes?
When I fell, I could have sworn that I was flying.
That part of you that was divine did fly, naturally. You are now fully mortal.
Mortal?
Take it from me. I know about these things.
Oh. Look, there's quite a few questions I'd like to ask.
There always are. I'm sorry.
Death clapped his heels to his horse's flanks and vanished. The king stood there as several servants came hurrying along the palace wall, slowed down as they approached his corpse, and advanced with caution.
Are you all right, oh, jeweled master of the sun?
One of them ventured.
No, I'm not, snapped the king, who was having some of his basic assumptions about the universe severely rattled,
and that never puts anyone in a good mood.
I'm by way of being dead just at the moment. Amazing, isn't it?
He said bitterly.
Can you hear us, O divine bringer of the morning?
Inquired the other servant, tiptoeing closer.
I've just fallen off a 100-foot wall onto my head. What do you think?
Shouted the king.
I don't think he can hear us, Yachmet, said the other servant.
Listen, said the king, whose urgency was equalled only by the servant's total inability to hear anything he was saying. You must find my son and tell him to forget about the pyramid business, at least until I've thought about it a bit. There are one or two points which seem a little self-contradictory about the whole afterlife arrangements, and...
Shall I shout?
Said Yachmet.
I don't think you can shout loud enough. I think he's dead.
Yachmet looked down at the stiffening corpse.
Bloody hell,
he said eventually.
Well, that's tomorrow up the spout for a start.
The sun, unaware that it was making its farewell performance, continued to drift smoothly above the rim of the world, and out of it, moving faster than any bird should be able to fly, a seagull bore down on Ankh Morpork, on the brass bridge, and eight still figures on one staring face. Seagulls were common enough in Ankh, but as this one flew over the group, it uttered one long, guttural scream that caused three of the thieves to drop their knives. Nothing with feathers ought to have been able to make a noise like that. It had claws in it. The bird wheeled in a tight circle and fluttered to a perch on a convenient wooden hippo, where it glared at the group with mad red eyes. The leading thief tore his fascinated gaze away from it, just as he heard Arthur say, quite pleasantly,
"This is a number 2 throwing knife. I got 96% for throwing knives. Which eyeball don't you need?"
The leader stared at him. As far as the other young assassins were concerned, he noticed, one was still staring fixedly at the seagull, while the other was busy being noisily sick over the parapet.
"There's only one of you," he said. "There's 5 of us."
"But soon there'll be only 4 of you," said Arthur.
Moving slowly, like someone in a daze, Tepic reached out his hand to the seagull. With any normal seagull, this would have resulted in the loss of a thumb, but the creature hopped onto it with the smug air of the master returning to the old plantation. It seemed to make the thieves increasingly uneasy. Arthur's smile wasn't helping either.
"That's a nice bird,"
said the leader, in the inanely cheerful tones of the extremely worried. Tepic was dreamily stroking its bullet head.
"I think it would be a good idea if you went away,"
said Arthur, as the bird shuffled sideways onto Tepic's wrist. Gripping with webbed feet, thrusting out its wings to maintain its balance, it should have looked clownish, but instead looked full of hidden power, as though it was an eagle's secret identity. When it opened its mouth, revealing a ridiculous purple bird tongue, there was a suggestion that this seagull could do a lot more than menace a seaside tomato sandwich.
"Is it magic?"
said one of the thieves, and was quickly hushed.
"We'll be going, then," said the leader. "Sorry about the misunderstanding."
Tepic gave him a warm, unseeing smile. Then they all heard the insistent little noise. 6 pairs of eyes swiveled around and down. Chidders were already in position. Below them, pouring darkly across the dehydrated mud, the Ankh was rising. Dios, First Minister and High Priest among High Priests, wasn't a naturally religious man. It wasn't a desirable quality in a High Priest. It affected your judgment, made you unsound. Start believing in things and the whole business became a farce.
Not that he had anything against belief. People needed to believe in gods, if only because it was hard to believe in people. The gods were necessary. He just required that they stayed out of the way and let him get on with things. Mind you, it was a blessing that he had the looks for it. If your genes saw fit to give you a tall frame, a bald head, and a nose you could plough rocks with, they probably had a definite aim in mind. He instinctively distrusted people to whom religion came easily. The naturally religious, he felt, were unstable, and given to wandering in the desert, and having revelations, as if the gods would lower themselves to that sort of thing. And they never got anything done. They started thinking that rituals weren't important. They started thinking that you could talk to the gods direct. Dios knew, with the kind of rigid and unbending certainty you could pivot the world on, that the gods of Djeli Baby liked rituals as much as anyone else. After all, a god who was against ritual would be like a fish who was against water. He sat on the steps of the throne with his staff across his knees and passed on the king's orders. The fact that they were not currently being issued by any king was not a problem. Dios had been high priest now for, well, more years than he cared to remember. He knew quite clearly what orders a sensible king would be giving, and he gave them. Anyway, the face of the sun was on the throne, and that was what mattered. It was a solid, gold, head-enveloping mask, to be worn by the current ruler on all public occasions. Its expression, to the sacrilegious, was one of good-natured constipation. For thousands of years, it had symbolized kingship in Djeli Baby. It had also made it very difficult to tell kings apart. This was extremely symbolic as well, although no one could remember what of. There was a lot of that sort of thing in the old kingdom. The staff across his knees, for example, with its very symbolic snakes entwined symbolically around an allegorical camel prod. The people believed this gave the high priest power over the gods and the dead. But this was probably a metaphor, i.e., a lie. Dios shifted position.
"Has the king been ushered to the room of going forth?" he said.
The circle of lesser high priests nodded.
"Dil the embalmer is attending upon him at this instant, O Dios." "Very well. And the builder of pyramids has been instructed?"
Hut Kumi, the high priest of Kefin, the two-faced god of gateways, stepped forward.
"I took the liberty of attending to that myself, O Dios," he purred.
Dios tapped his fingers on his staff.
"Yes," he said, "I have no doubt that you did."
It was widely expected by the priesthood that Kumi would be the one to succeed Dios in the event of Dios ever actually dying, although hanging around waiting for Dios to die had never seemed to be a rewarding occupation. The only dissenting opinion was that of Dios himself, who, if he had any friends, would probably have confided in them certain conditions that would need to apply first, viz., blue moons, aerial pigs, and he, Dios, being seen in hell. He would probably have added that the only difference between Kumi and a sacred crocodile was the crocodile's basic honesty of purpose.
"Very well," he said.
"If I may remind your lordship," said Kumi.
The faces of the other priests went a nice safe blank as Dios glared.
"Yes, Kumi."
"The prince, O Dios. Has he been summoned?"
"No,"
said Dios.
"Then how will he know?"
said Kumi.
"He will know," said Dios firmly.
"How will this be?"
"He will know. And now you are all dismissed. Go away. See to your gods."
They scurried out, leaving Dios alone on the steps. It had been his accustomed position for so long that he'd polished a groove in the stonework into which he fitted exactly. Of course the prince would know. It was part of the neatness of things. But in the grooves of his mind, ground deeply by years of ritual and due observance, Dios detected a certain uneasiness. It was not at home in there. Uneasiness was something that happened to other people. He hadn't got where he was today by allowing room for doubt. Yet there was a tiny thought back there, a tiny certainty, that there was going to be trouble with this new king. Well, the boy would soon learn. They all learned. He shifted position and winced. The aches and pains were back, and he couldn't allow that. They got in the way of his duty, and his duty was a sacred trust. He'd have to visit the necropolis again. Tonight.
"He's not himself, you can see that."
"Who is he, then?" said Chidda.
They splashed unsteadily down the street, not drunkenly this time, but with the awkward gait of two people trying to do the steering for three. Tepic was walking, but not in a way that gave them any confidence that his mind was having any part of it. Around them, doors were being thrown open, curses were being cursed. There was the sound of furniture being dragged up to first-floor rooms.
"Must have been a hell of a storm up in the mountains," said Arthur. "It doesn't usually flood like this, even in the spring."
"Maybe we should burn some feathers under his nose," suggested Chidder.
"That bloody seagull would be favourite," Arthur growled.
"What seagull?"
"You saw it."
"Well, what about it?"
"You did see it, didn't you?"
Uncertainty flickered its dark flame in Arthur's eyes. The seagull had disappeared in all the excitement.
"My attention was a bit occupied," said Chidder diffidently. "It must have been those mint wafers they served with the coffee. I thought they were a bit off."
"Definitely a touch eldritch, that bird," said Arthur. "Look, let's put him down somewhere while I empty the water out of my boots, can we?"
There was a bakery nearby, its doors thrown open so that the trays of new loaves could cool in the early morning. They propped Tepic against the wall.
"He looks as though someone hit him on the head," said Chidder. "No one did they?"
Arthur shook his head. Tepic's face was locked in a gentle grin. Whatever his eyes were focused on wasn't occupying the usual set of dimensions.
"We ought to get him back to the guild and into the sanatorium."
He stopped. There was a peculiar rustling sound behind him. The loaves of bread were bouncing gently on their trays. One or two of them vibrated onto the floor, where they spun around like overturned beetles. Then, their crusts cracking open like eggshells, they sprouted hundreds of green shoots. Within a few seconds, the trays were waving stands of young corn, their heads already beginning to fill out and bend over. Through them marched Chidder and Arthur, poker-faced, doing the 100-metre nonchalant walk, with Tepic held rigidly between them.
"Is it him doing all this?"
"I've got a feeling that..."
Arthur looked behind them, just in case any angry bakers had come out and spotted such aggressively wholemeal produce, and stopped so suddenly that the other two swung around him like a rudder. They looked thoughtfully at the street.
"Not something you see every day, that," said Chidder at last.
"You mean the way there's grass and stuff growing up everywhere he puts his feet?"
Yes.
Their eyes met. As one, they looked down at Tepic's shoes. He was already ankle-deep in greenery, which was cracking the centuries-old cobbles in its urgency. Without speaking a word, they gripped his elbows and lifted him into the air.
"The san," said Arthur.
"The san," agreed Chidder.
But they both knew even then that this was going to involve more than a hot poultice. The doctor sat back.
"Fairly straightforward," he said, thinking quickly. "A case of mortis portalis taculatum, with complications."
"What's that mean?" said Chidder.
"In layman's terms," the doctor sniffed, "he's as dead as a doornail."
"What are the complications?"
The doctor looked shifty.
"He's still breathing," he said. "Look, his pulse is nearly humming, and he's got a temperature you could fry eggs on."
He hesitated, aware that this was probably too straightforward and easily understood. Medicine was a new art on the disc and wasn't going to get anywhere if people could understand it.
"Pyrocerebrin OF culinary," he said, after working it out in his head.
"Well, what could you do about it?" said Arthur.
"Nothing. He's dead. All the medical tests prove it. So, bury him, keep him nice and cool, and tell him to come and see me next week. In daylight, for preference."
"But he's still breathing."
"These are just reflex actions that might easily confuse the layman," said the doctor airily.
Chidder sighed. He suspected that the guild, who after all had an unrivalled experience of sharp knives and complex organic compounds, were much better at elementary diagnostics than were the doctors. The guild might kill people, but at least it didn't expect them to be grateful for it. Tepic opened his eyes.
"I must go home," he said. "Dead, is he?" said Chidder.
The doctor was a credit to his profession.
"It's not unusual for a corpse to make distressing noises after death," he said valiantly, "which can upset relatives and..."
Tepic sat bolt upright.
"Also, muscular spasms in the stiffening body can, in certain circumstances..." the doctor began, but his heart wasn't in it anymore.
Then an idea occurred to him.
"It's a rare and mysterious ailment," he said, "which is going around a lot at the moment. It's caused by something so small it can't be detected in any way whatsoever."
he finished, with a self-congratulatory smile on his face. It was a good one, he had to admit. He'd have to remember it.
"Thank you very much," said Chidder, opening the door and ushering him through. "Next time we're feeling really well, we'll definitely call you in."
"It's probably a walrus," said the doctor, as he was gently but firmly propelled out of the room. "He's caught a walrus. There's a lot of it going, The door slammed shut. Tepic swung his legs off the bed and clutched at his head.
"I've got to go home," he repeated.
"Why?" said Arthur.
"Don't know. The kingdom wants me."
"You seem to be taken pretty bad there," Arthur began.
Tepic waved his hands dismissively.
"Look," he said, "please, I don't want anyone sensibly pointing out things. I don't want anyone telling me I should rest. None of it matters. I will be back in the kingdom as soon as possible. It's not a case of must, you understand. I will. And you can help me, Chidi."
"How?"
"Your father has an extremely fast vessel he uses for smuggling," said Tepic flatly. "He will lend it to me in exchange for favorable consideration of future trading opportunities. If we leave inside the hour, it will do the journey in plenty of time."
"My father is an honest trader."
"On the contrary, 70% of his income last year was from undeclared trading in the following commodities." Tepic's eyes stared into nothingness. "From illegal transport of galleons and lucars, 9%. From night running of untaxed..."
"Well, 30% honest," Chidder admitted. "Which is a lot more honest than most. You'd better tell me how you know, extremely quickly."
"I don't know," said Tepic. "When I was asleep, it seemed I knew everything, everything about everything. I think my father is dead."
"Oh," said Chidder. "Gosh, I'm sorry."
"Oh, no, it's not like that. It's what he would have wanted. I think he was rather looking forward to it. In our family, death is when you really start to, you know, enjoy life. I expect he's rather enjoying it."
In fact, the Pharaoh was sitting on a spare slab in the ceremonial preparation room, watching his own soft bits being carefully removed from his body and put into the special canopic jars. This is not a sight often seen by people, at least not by people in a position to take a thoughtful interest. He was rather upset. Although he was no longer officially inhabiting his body, he was still attached to it by some sort of occult bond, and it is hard to be very happy at seeing two artisans up to the elbows in bits of you. The jokes aren't funny either. Not when you are, as it were, the butt.
"Luke, Master Dill,"
said Gurn, a plump, red-faced young man who the king had learned was the new apprentice.
"Luke? Right, watch this. Watch this. Luke, your name in lights. Get it? Your name in lights. See?"
"Just put them in the jar, boy," said Dill wearily. "And while we're on the subject, I didn't think much of the Gottler gear routine, either."
"Sorry, Master."
"And pass me over a number 3 brain hook while you're up that end, will you?"
"Coming right up, Master," said Gurn.
"And don't jog me. This is a fiddly bit."
"Sure thing."
The king craned nearer. Gurn rummaged around at his end of the job, and then gave a long, low whistle.
"Whew! Will you look at the colour of this?" he said. "You wouldn't think so, would you? Is it something they eat, Master?"
Dill sighed.
"Just put it in the pot, Gurn."
"Right you are, Master." "Master?"
"Yes, lad."
"Which bit's got the god in it, Master?"
Dill squinted up the king's nostril, trying to concentrate.
"That gets sorted out before he comes down here," he said patiently.
"I wondered," said Gurn, "because there's not a jar for it, you see."
"No, there wouldn't be. It'd have to be a rather strange jar, Gurn."
Gurn looked a bit disappointed.
"Oh," he said, "so he's just ordinary then, is he?"
"In a strictly organic sense," said Dill, his voice slightly muffled.
"Our mum said he was all right as a king," said Gurn. "What do you think?"
Dill paused with a jar in his hand, and seemed to give the conversation some thought for the first time.
"Never think about it until they come down here," he said. "I suppose he was better than most. Nice pair of lungs, clean kidneys, good big sinuses, which is what I always look for in a king."
He looked down and delivered his professional judgment.
pleasure to work with, really. Our mum said his heart was in the right place, said Gurn.
The king, hovering dismally in the corner, gave a gloomy nod. Yes, he thought. Jar 3, top shelf. Dill wiped his hands on a rag and sighed. Possibly 35 years in the funeral business, which had given him a steady hand, a philosophic manner, and a keen interest in vegetarianism, had also granted him powers of hearing beyond the ordinary. Because he was almost persuaded that right beside his ear, someone else sighed too. The king wandered sadly over to the other side of the room and stared at the dull liquid of the preparation vat. Funny that. When he was alive, it had all seemed so sensible, so obvious. Now he was dead. It looked like a huge waste of effort. It was beginning to annoy him. He watched Dill and his apprentice tidy up, burn some ceremonial resins, lift him, it, up, carry it respectfully across the room, and slide it gently into the oily embrace of the preservative. Tepikaimon the 27th gazed into the murky depths at his own body lying sadly on the bottom like the last pickled gherkin in the jar. He raised his eyes to the sacks in the corner. They were full of straw. He didn't need telling what was going to be done with it. The boat didn't glide. It insinuated itself through the water, dancing across the waves on the tips of the 12 oars, spreading like an oil slick, gliding like a bird. It was matte black and shaped like a shark. There was no drummer to beat the rhythm. The boat didn't want the weight. Anyway, he'd have needed the full kit, including snares. Tepik sat between the lines of silent rowers in the narrow gully that was the cargo hold. Better not to speculate what cargoes. The boat looked designed to move very small quantities of things very quickly and without anyone noticing, and he doubted whether even the Smugglers' Guild was aware of its existence. Commerce was more interesting than he thought. They found the delta with suspicious ease. How many times had this whispering shadow slipped up the river, he wondered. And above the exotic smells from the mysterious former cargo, he could detect the sense of home. Crocodile dung, reed pollen, water lily blossoms, lack of plumbing, the rank of lions and reek of hippos. The leading oarsman tapped him gently on the shoulder and motioned him up, steadied him as he stepped overboard into a few feet of water. By the time he'd waded ashore, the boat had turned and was a mere suspicion of a shadow downstream. Because he was naturally curious, Tepik wondered where it would lie up during the day, since it had the look about it of a boat designed to travel only under the cover of darkness, and decided that it had probably lurked somewhere in the high reed marshes on the delta. And, because he was now a king, he made a mental note to have the marshes patrolled periodically from now on. A king should know things. He stopped, ankle-deep in river ooze. He had known everything. Arthur had rambled on vaguely about seagulls and rivers and loaves of bread sprouting, which suggested he'd drunk too much. All Tepik could remember was waking up with a terrible sense of loss, as his memory failed to hold and leaked away its new treasures. It was like the tremendous insights that come in dreams and vanish on waking. He'd known everything, but as soon as he tried to remember what it was, it poured out of his head as from a leaky bucket. But it had left him with a new sensation. Before, his life had been ambling along, bent by circumstance. Now, it was clicking along on bright rails. Perhaps he hadn't got it in him to be an assassin, but he knew he could be a king. His feet found solid ground. The boat had dropped him off a little way downstream of the palace, and blue in the moonlight the pyramid flares on the far bank were filling the night with their familiar glow. The abodes of the happy dead came in all sizes, although not, of course, in all shapes. They clustered thickly nearer the city, as though the dead like company, and even the oldest ones were all complete. No one had borrowed any of the stones to build houses or make roads. Tepik felt obscurely proud of that. No one had unsealed the doors and wandered around inside to see if the dead had any old treasures they weren't using anymore. And every day, without fail, food was left in the little antechambers. The commissaries of the dead occupied a large part of the palace. Sometimes the food went, sometimes it didn't. The priests, however, were very clear on this point. Regardless of whether the food was consumed or not, it had been eaten by the dead. Presumably, they enjoyed it. They never complained or came back for seconds. Look after the dead, said the priests, and the dead would look after you. After all, they were in the majority. Tepik pushed aside the reeds. He straightened his clothing, brushed some mud off his sleeve, and set off for the palace. Ahead of him, dark against the flare light, stood the great statue of Kuft. 7,000 years ago, Kuft had led his people out of... Tepic couldn't remember, but somewhere where they hadn't liked being, probably, and for thoroughly good reasons. It was at times like this he wished he knew more history, and had prayed in the desert, and the gods of the place had shown him the old kingdom. And he had entered, yea, and taken possession thereof, and it should ever be the dwelling place of his seed. Something like that, anyway. They were probably more yeas and a few verilies, with added milk and honey. But the sight of that great patriarchal face, that outstretched arm, that chin you could crack stones on, bold in the flare light, told him what he already knew. He was home, and he was never going to leave again. The sun began to rise. The greatest mathematician alive on the disk, and in fact the last one in the old kingdom, stretched out in his stall and counted the piece of ore in his bedding. Then he estimated the number of nails in the wall. Then he spent a few minutes proving that an automorphic resonance field has a semi-infinite number of irresolute prime ideals. After that, in order to pass the time, he ate his breakfast again.